of the meeting, just to go back to the position that we were moving towards before lunch, looking at the paper on iForest 2 and whether the principles were actually going to work for us in practice or not. Sense I get from the comments that many people have made around the room is that perhaps the principles that we were describing were themselves open to a little interpretation. Alarmingly, some of you had suggested that we just take on US GAAP and achieve convergence at a stroke. Might be a step too far, I think, for the Interpretations Committee to take at this stage. But it did give us something to think about. Substantial majority seemed to be in agreement that the end result was, shall we say, more desirable than we've got at the moment, and that for many of you the principles helped you to understand how to get there, but a small but vocal minority felt that, in fact, the principles just raised too many questions and it wouldn't actually answer many of the problems that we got at the moment, and it will create some new ones of their own. Or in other words, I think you're saying that you didn't think that by changing anything that it would be an improvement to existing IFRS literature. However, we are not going to be disheartened, so we have a thought which I'd like to test out on you on here. Again, I emphasize that we haven't decided what we're going to do with this project. What we have to first do is to decide if we can find some improvement in financial reporting as a result of making some changes or issuing some more authoritative guidance to the world at large. One of the things that the Interpretations Committee can do is to issue an interpretation. We do that from time to time. We interpret the existing literature. We also now, from this year, have been taking on annual improvements, but the criteria for each of those, although similar types of issues, are slightly different. But to take on something like US GAAP would be something that is outside the scope of IFRIC's activities. It's something, certainly, that we could recommend to the board that they consider as an improvement going forward. And we wouldn't have to do very much work on that at all, so perhaps to some of us that in itself would represent an improvement. I'm also mindful, though, of the workload of the current board, which is going to extend over quite some time ahead, and the need, almost a pressing need, for a resolution to the current practice difficulties, and therefore how we can address that. So working on the assumption that there is something we can do, and we'll decide later exactly what that is, perhaps the proposal that I would suggest is to consider whether or not, putting aside the principles as they're written at the moment, that if we were to think of embarking in interpretive type of mode, how would we best reach a resolution to this problem? And I think that's really what Jeho and Michael have been doing so far, to say, well, existing IFRS 2 with its existing definitions is leading us down this approach to try and build interpretively or to fill in the gaps of what different things mean. In itself, the two attributes perhaps look to some of you as a little contrived or inappropriate, and that there are better ways of coming to a conclusion. Some have said, of course, and I think quite rightly, that in the US people don't have a problem in distinguishing between performance conditions and market conditions, and can get on with life, and in part that's because the definitions are slightly different in there. So one of the things that we could think of doing is to make a recommendation to modify the definitions as part of the interpretive process, that is to continue to develop the guidance to explain the principles that people would be using, but at the same time to think, is there some minimal change we can make to the existing IFRS 2 definitions, almost as a consequential amendment to clarify, so so that it makes our interpretation less convoluted, clearer to the point, and addresses the application issues, particularly the ones of multiple existing conditions and how we address accounting for those multiple conditions within the ambit generally of the overall principles of IFRS 2. So what I'd like to do is perhaps miss out on question 1, drive you into question 2 in a way. Not quite as the staff have written this, so when we're talking about the combination of the two attributes, then perhaps we still need a little bit of thought into how we would articulate that. But to put the attributes together in the sense that what we're looking for is something that is, in brutal terms, either going to be accounted for by estimating the outcome and truing up as we go through the life of the share-based payment, or it's something that is a market condition that we would reflect in the fair value measurement at day one, and therefore not have the true-up that follows subsequently. So I suppose the question is, not only do you think we should do that, but do you think we should continue to debate this topic as a result of doing that? So, Michael, is there anything you want to add, your J-Ho? So I open it to the floor. Guido, you want to go first?
I guess if we take this on the agenda, I think the best way to do it is by an annual improvement project. I'm struggling seeing an interpretation, if I understood you correctly, where we change something that is in IFRS 2 right now. So the way I can see it is look at the questions that have been raised, which just has been, or have been reiterated by you, Bob, and look at IFRS 2 and whether we can help to clarify what a performance condition is, what distinguishes it from a market condition, and also when we have multiple vesting conditions, how you deal with that. And I think we can very base this answer on the table that we have seen from the staff, which I found very good for the second question. The first one, I still have problems with the two principles. I've said that, so I don't want to say that again. But I think that we may want to look when we take it on as an annual improvement project what US GAAP says, because I think that US GAAP comes to the right answer because they don't have these two attributes. At least I have not seen this in the things that US GAAP says. They simply define what a performance condition is, but they don't say what lies behind that attribute. If they would have these two attributes, they may have the same problems that we have.
Okay, I think the staff were trying to develop and explain the underlying rationale for the principle to help people in the situations that we hadn't yet identified that may cause problems later. Scott?
Question 2, as written in the paper that I think we're still looking at, 3B, is does the committee agree with the staff recommendation that the combination of the two attributes should be represented by a performance condition defined by reference to the operation or activities of the entity? I think that wording is more similar to the U.S. GAAP definition than is trying to define the two attributes. So perhaps where we're headed is the attributes are all well and good for us to talk about here, but maybe whatever interpretation or annual improvement or whatever we write shouldn't have the attributes and should just jump to the definition, which I agree with, although there's a second part of what's written in question 2 right now that says, and an implicit or explicit service requirement throughout the attribution period. I'm not sure if that's meaning to reference the performance measurement period, but you've got an example here where the performance measurement period is longer than the service period and have concluded in 3C that that is a non-vesting condition, which I think that is actually a different answer than we would get in the U.S. Well, in that case, companies are doing it wrong, because every company I know that has a work for 1 year and you vest, and we'll decide how many you vest in after 2 years, because we'll see if your performance generated the results that we wanted it to generate, they all account for that as a performance condition. Because if it wasn't a performance condition, it would be a liability award. Because it couldn't be a service condition, it couldn't be a market condition. If it ain't a performance condition, it must be other, and U.S. GAAP, that makes it a liability. Nobody's doing that.
That you, Ruth?
There's a waterfall in there. Just some, if I can ask for some clarification. If the proposal is for us to proceed with this as an interpretation, are we able to... and I know we're able to amend the standard at the same time, but are we able to issue the interpretation on the assumption that we have amended the standard? In other words, we can make the amendments so as to issue the interpretation.
Well, procedurally, it's not part of my proposal to say that this is going to go as an interpretation at the moment. I'm just trying to see if this is a way we can get resolution among ourselves of what an answer to fix or to address the problem might be. If we were going to issue, as we have done on other occasions, an interpretation that requires a consequential amendment to an existing standard, the approval procedure is slightly different, because instead of just negative clearance, which is what we're talking about on deferred stripping, the board would have to vote positively, at least 9 votes at the moment, to make the amendments to the standard. But the way that we would write the interpretation would be taking into account those consequential amendments to the standards. That is, as if the changes had already been made.
Okay.
So it would be a package that we would then present to the board.
Okay. Well, if that was the case, then I would be happy with that approach as opposed to annual improvements, because I don't think this is an improvement. This is much bigger.
Okay. But
yeah.
Can I ask you the real question then, which I assume is yes, that if we focus on the middle part of question 2, that is, we should, rather than focusing on the individual attributes, focus on a performance condition defined by reference to the operation or activities of the entity. And in addition, I think we've also got to consider this point that Scott had raised about the attribution period, to make it clear what we do there for multiple conditions. Yeah. Okay. Bernd?
Just one procedural question. Does that mean that we are interpreting something that is not yet in the standard, and then we put it in the standard to fit the standard to the interpretation?
Bernd, I was wondering how long it would take you to cease to be a practical preparer and be a full-blown hypothetical academic. And the trouble is, you're in between both at the moment. So procedurally, because IFRS 2 has already been issued, people are having to interpret the requirements of our IFRS 2. So we are now trying to develop an authoritative position to remove the doubt or the lack of clarity, doubt in people's minds or lack of clarity in the existing standard as to what was intended, or alternatively, what should be done now. Andrew?
Well, without wishing to be the party pooper again, aren't we? I mean, it seems a bit odd to try and call these consequential amendments, because I think if we go down this route, we're going down there in the full knowledge that we're actually going to change some of the principles in IFRS 2, which seems odd territory for an interpretation to start with. I know the post-implementation project's another alternative, and frankly, of the three that we discussed, I would have thought that's the more appropriate given what we're contemplating doing here.
Any other comments? Laurence?
As I said before, I'm definitely not convinced that defining performance condition as it is proposed is operational. so I'm not convinced that this is going to result in an improvement. I believe that it will just generate as much diversity as we currently have, so very much supportive.
If I can just follow up. When you say that the performance condition definition, do you actually mean the definition that's taken out of U.S. GAAP, which we broadly say to follow, maybe not exactly word for word, but potentially? Or do you mean rationale that we're asking the IFRC to consider just simply as a potential for basis for conclusions, meaning that the two attributes? Because if you only object to the discussion of the two attributes, as others have pointed out, we could potentially just not include that in the final basis for conclusions and simply say, here is more prescriptive, better defined definitions. And that will then get us to an end result. Or you still think there would be diversity?
It's very difficult to respond to the question without knowing effectively how you address SOE plans, IPOs, change of control. And if it is, if currently, if the proposal is that you address these as you propose, I still have difficulty making them fit with what you propose for performance conditions. So, plus the fact that I do have the same concern as Scott expressed about, I think it's example HT or H, where you say it's a non-vesting condition. It's a G, performance target measured over a period exceeding the service period, where you conclude it's a non-vesting condition. And I do not understand this conclusion. And in the same way as I do not understand the proposed definition of what is a vesting condition.
Scott?
With respect to the IPO change of control, I think that the definition works because it says performance condition defined by reference to the operation or activities of the entity. I think clearly a change of control and IPO are by reference to the operation or activities of the entity. I agree it's hard to fit them into the attributes. The employee is able to influence the entity and in the interest of the entity stuff. IPO change of control, the influence thing is a little hard. But if we jump to the definition, if the issue is can we answer the question, well, yeah, I think an IPO and change of control are clearly attributes that are defined by reference to the operation or activities of the entity. I think that works. Say it as you are, and I agree, Laurence. I have the same issue. I don't know if that's by reference to the operation or activities of the entity, but I have a completely different model that I'd write for save as you are, anyways. And you know, I think the issue of the performance measurement period that exceeds the service period is going to exist no matter what we do with the definition. We need to answer that question separately or in conjunction with answering anything else.
All right, I've
been struggling to reconcile the example of change in control with the notion of quantity versus quality of service that is a basis for your foundation. To me, a vesting condition that says you stay until the change in control is a quantity measure because it doesn't have anything to do with the quality of the service during that period. And the ability of the employee to influence the change in control is at least in the type of corporate governance environments I know is very remote. Who decides change in control? The owners of the entity, not the entity in most cases. The performance of the entity might induce the owners of the entity to do something, or some market participants to have a takeoff or bid, but the employee is far remote from that, and it seems to me. So I like very much the concept. I like some of the examples that then, when it comes to applying this test, I say, well, I no longer understand anything to the rationale.
Peter?
I understand Philip's concerns, but we would not have these problems if we would not have these attributes anymore. I'm also a little bit struggling with these change the view from the entity that receives the services to the employee, and do they provide qualitative services? I think if we restrict, as Scott says, to what the definition of a performance condition is, from the point of view of the entity, we would not have this problem anymore. I agree with Philip that we will have it if we would still have the attributes, but if we don't have them...
The position B41B, specifically a change in control, is proposed to be a performance condition.
Yes, with respect to Philippe's comments on change of control, and yes, we were trying to create consistency with what we deem to be good attributes. I think you can, to the extent that the committee decides and the board would ultimately agree, you could make an argument that a change of control provision is simply a service requirement that is required. At that point, it's just not a defined time period. It would be a service-only condition that has an, at least currently, undetermined length of time. In my opinion, you'd probably have to follow on with additional guidance that would say, given the improbability of knowing whether or not they're going to stay that long and things, it's you don't recognize any expense until it actually occurs, but that's similar to where we are in current IFRS 2 as well as U.S. GAAP, so the end answer, again, would be the same. But I think that's more rationalization on the back end for discussion.
Okay, Ruth?
Going back to those attributes, and it seems that the attributes are causing more of an issue than the definition proposed in 2. When one of the suggestions could be that instead of the in the interests of the entity, because I think as Bernd said earlier, it's unlikely the entity is going to propose something to its employees that's not in the interest of the entity. I mean, having more children is a very unlikely thing that they say you'd have to do. So I would have thought that talking about the ability of the entity to influence rather than the interests of the entity is a more practicable notion. And then it also gets away from the level of employee within the organisation and arguments about whether a junior person can influence profit or a senior one. That becomes largely irrelevant to that sort of issue. But we know that the entity can influence it. And I acknowledge that then you get into arguments about who the entity is and is it the shareholders or not. But the guidance can draw the line and say, in the case of a change of control provision, we assume that is more within the influence of the entity than not within the influence. And therefore, we treat it as a performance rather than as a market. If we don't agree with it, we could switch it the other way around. But it's a way we can draw the line. And I think that's what people are asking us to do, is tell us where we draw the line so that we know whether to include things in the measurement up front or not. That's what they're asking for. And if we can't agree with that, how do we expect practitioners to be able to apply the standards? Which is why I would support what Bob has recommended, which is to go down the path of an interpretation that amends the standard to be more workable at the same time. Whether or not it's exactly the right answer that everybody agrees with is probably not that relevant anymore. People are asking for certainty. And if we can get closer to US GAAP in the process so that the answer is consistent with the US GAAP answer, then I think we've done more good than harm.
Julie?
In case it's helpful, I can give you a little history behind the US GAAP answer and what prompted it. Because it was actually developed at the Emerging Issues Task Force, and then their consensus got rolled into 123R when the board redid stock comp. But the practice issue that came up to the ITF was really the market conditions. In essence, people were tagging stock options to like the price of gold and sort of, I want to say laundering, that sounds too pejorative, but I'll say it anyway, laundering through stock option accounting model, an instrument where the economics was really, you know, tied to commodity prices or the, you know, S&P 500 index, and yet you were getting stock comp accounting, even though the economics were more like a real derivative tied to, you know, price of copper, you name it. So the practice problem was, this doesn't seem right, and so that's what the EITF set out to do, or primarily was to define these market conditions and say, hey, if it's tagged to the stuff which is outside the company, that's not regular stock option accounting, that's not right. I mean, that was their first order of business. But then in going through it, obviously to have that discussion, then people brought up, well, what about, you know, things that are a little more tied to the company but are fancier than just show up for 3 years and you vest. And so the middle category became performance conditions. And it was sort of, I don't want to say it's a residual category, but in essence it was a residual category because pure service was easy. These pure market things, which is what sort of the abuse they were trying to stop, was sort of easy once you put the words around it. And then you had things in the middle, which it was like, okay, it's not the abuse we're trying to stop, but it's not simple service, so we'll make that point. And so the word, the title, performance condition came in. But the reason I bring it up is the exercise wasn't to debate what exactly is performance or not, or to try to, you know, be really narrow about performance. Well, if I'm the work janitor, I can't influence the IPO, therefore if it's my stock option, it's not performance, but if it's the... I mean, that was never part of it. The original exercise was just to have three buckets, the vanilla service, the sort of abusive market, and then kind of everything else in the middle. Now, that's not to say that in implementing it, you don't have to make some judgment calls, but that's why I think they didn't sweat so much about trying to analyze who could influence what as to whether it was a performance condition. I don't know if that's helpful.
Yep. No, thanks, Julie. That was helpful to get the background. All right, final two comments, then we'll call for a vote. Laurence?
Yeah, it was to pick up on Bruce's comment. With the proposed definition of performance condition, I'm not sure I am able also to really distinguish between market conditions and the other vesting conditions. To what extent are we going to draw a line when there are some share price-related conditions? How do they tie into, relations within an entity's performance? I do believe that it's going to be very difficult to draw a line.
We aren't proposing that any line be drawn between other conditions such as gold or S&P 500 and external targets such as the share price of the entity, so a market condition, because the accounting is exactly the same. So if we were to try and draw a line, it wouldn't matter which side of the line you're on. So the staff could draw a line, but then I don't think you would get diversity in practice because people wouldn't be too fussed over which side you wanted to rationalize it on. The answer is the same.
Guido?
I think what Julie just said was very helpful. I tend to disagree with what Ruth said, trying to define some attribute, switching from who can influence it from the employer to the entity makes it not easier. You could also argue, well, the change of control cannot be influenced by the entity, but there is also some external influence because you need to have somebody who takes control of your company, and you can obviously not force these people. So I think the way, if I understood it correctly, Julie said in the U.S., which makes for me a lot of sense, what they do is they say there's something which is clearly not performance because it's tagged to gold price or something. Then we have performance conditions, which are service conditions, very easy. The rest is performance conditions, and what we then have to distinguish, as I understand it, is market-based performance conditions because they are measured differently based on practicability issues, which is, by the way, the model we have right now in IFRS 2. So there is not a lot that we need to change. That's why I said, well, let's look at the annual improvement project to make clearer by defining what a performance condition is, and then maybe we could look at US GAAP, and that might solve the problem. I'm still having problems with the attributes. Sorry.
If I can just respond, I agree with you. I was not recommending that we actually go into much more on the attributes because I think we would end up arguing for years on them. So I was suggesting that we could put in another one but acknowledge that it's going to cause the same sorts of issues, and I would much rather go with just the definition as it is, and the three buckets that Julie's described is much more the way I was thinking anyway.
Right, so if you can look at question two and delete any reference and any thoughts of the attributes. so that we start with a definition, defining the performance condition. Would anybody disagree with that modified staff recommendation? Is that a yes, Lawrence? There are no abstains. You either disagree or you don't. So you're not disagreeing then. Okay. And then on to question three. But assuming that we have now done that, would you agree with the staff recommendation that for all of the three examples that are given in there, that they should be explicitly deemed to constitute a performance condition? Does anybody disagree with that staff recommendation? Okay, let's start with Scott.
I very much agree on the IPO and change of control that those should be performance conditions. They are related to the operation or activities of the entity. It works. The save as you earn, I don't think that is related to the operations of the entity, so I think it fails the definition. Moreover, my concern about treating contributions to a save as you earn plan as a performance condition is plan gets started, stock price goes down, the option is now out of the money, person says, ah, never mind, I don't need to make these contributions anymore, and we reverse the expense. That would be the only time I can see a situation where we actually reverse the expense simply because the stock price goes down. I happen to think that the contributions to a save-as-you-earn plan is really payment of the exercise price. I don't think of it as a vesting condition, a non-vesting condition, other vesting condition, performance market or service. That's just payment of the exercise price, and we don't reverse expense when a person decides not to pay the exercise price. So I would take a save-as-you-earn plan out of this. I don't believe it's a performance condition, and in fact, I don't believe it fits into many of these other categories as well. Right now, it's a non-vesting condition, I think, according to the latest amendments. I can work with it in that category, but really I think of it as the exercise price.
Okay. Guido?
100% share Scott's view.
Lawrence?
I have the same problem with SAYE plan as Scott explained.
Andrew?
Same point.
Before we go any further, if I can... not to slow down the path of people actually making decisions on us moving forward, but I understand the desire for the SAYE plan not to be a performance condition, which you'd re-estimate forfeitures and all that. Okay. But your statements that it, your view that it is simply the prepayment, you could say, the periodic prepayment of the exercise price, well, I agree that is a function of it. I still believe that the employee, by continuing to give service, is so-called purchasing their right to do that. Because then they have the right to either, at the end of the period or in the middle, whenever, request the cash back that has been prepaid, or actually exercise the option. So I do believe that the new optionality they have is still of value and needs to be accounted for under IFRS 2. If we say it's only a prepayment of exercise price, I think you could then leap to saying, so this has no IFRS 2 implications, and I don't know that that's correct. I just wanted to get your thoughts on...
There's a service condition, obviously. So, I mean, if the plan says you have to work and make contributions for 5 years, there's a five-year service condition. And then with respect to the contributions, it's a sinking fund for the exercise price. If you decide to exercise, then you exercise out of that fund. If you don't decide to exercise, you take the money out of the sinking fund. It's not... To me, it's not any different than that. I don't even view it as prepayment to the exercise price because it's still your money as the employee. You still have the complete discretion over whether to take that money back or use it to exercise the option. So all it is a requirement that in order to continue to keep the option, you have to prove you have enough money to exercise by making these deposits. And you know, again, I wouldn't bother with that. I think we've got a service requirement, and if the service is provided, the expense should be recognized. If the service is not provided, the expense should not be recognized. Well, if they stop saving, then they've just elected not to exercise the option. That doesn't say anything about whether the service is provided. We go on and continue to do the accounting for the service. Now, one could also say that it's a cancellation, and so then you're going to immediately recognize all the expense, which I think is what's done now as a non-vesting condition. As I said, I live with that as well. I think that's a workable answer. What concerns me absolutely is the issue of stock price goes down, therefore stop making contributions, and the company reverses all the expense, because I can tell you what, it's not going to take long for compensation consultants to say, no, put into your options that if they want to keep the option, they have to pre-fund the exercise price, and then what will happen is if the stock price goes down significantly, you'll get to reverse all the expense. Because everybody will stop pre-funding. I mean, we're looking at this in the context of a government-encouraged plan, the save-as-you-earn plan, but creative compensation consultants will realize that, hey, it doesn't matter if the plan is pursuant to a government regulation or not. You could put that provision in.
I think the subset of what you've been talking about, though, Scott, that caused some concern when the previous amendments were put through was where an employee had not completed the service period and was either intending voluntarily or otherwise to leave the company and would not be able to meet the service condition, and a month or 2 months before they left the organization, they stopped the contributions. So had they perhaps not stopped the contributions, you would have got a different accounting than this...
And that's the reason why my preference isn't the current account, which does call that a cancellation. My preference is to just look at it as part of the exercise price. So that ceasing to make the contributions wouldn't
have any
trigger speeding up the expense. You'd still go on, and if the employee continues to provide service, you'd recognize the expense, and if the employee does not, you'd eventually reverse the expense.
All right. Let me put it differently then to you. Question three. If we, at the moment, bear with me, Michael, if we delete the reference to the savings requirement in a save-as-you-earn plan, so it's only the IPO and the change of control, and we give these as explicit examples, would anybody object to that staff recommendation? You said you agreed with those two, Laurence, before. No? Okay. So one person disagrees. Now, the other question is whether or not we want to give more consideration to the save-as-you-earn plans to perhaps make it clear that it's not the decision to stop saving that would cause a change in the accounting, but it's whether or not the options would vest in the fullness of time. So I think, as Scott explained, if somebody stopped saving but carried on working,
they want that.
In what circumstances would that be considered to be a cancellation or not? Whether you have any appetite for continuing to look at this one change, I think, Michael, this was about the only change to current accounting that was going to be made. So whether you have any appetite to thinking about whether we would change that accounting. Scott?
I think, as I said, my preference would be to not take into account the savings requirement as any kind of condition. It is simply the exercise price, and the decision by an employee to not exercise an option doesn't affect the accounting at all. We record the expense if they provide the service, we reverse the expense if they don't, and I continue doing it that way. I'm not certain that this is a big enough deal to make a change to current accounting. As I understand it, if I follow correctly, this changing the accounting for save-as-you-earn would clearly require an amendment to a relatively recent previous decision. I don't, frankly, know how prevalent these things are. They don't exist like this in the U.S. We have various kinds of employee stock purchase plans, but they don't have this feature to them, at least not in the way that it's described here. So I'm, at least based on my knowledge, I'd be willing to stick with the current accounting. But if we are going to make a change to save as you earn, I'd prefer to make the change to say that the savings requirement is not a condition that gets taken into account at all.
Okay. Laurence?
I'm not sure how the board is going to appreciate that we challenge the decisions they have made not long ago.
We can't second guess what the board is going to think here.
Yeah.
I'm asking opinion. I'm asking for your opinion, Laurence, as to whether you want to do some more work on this.
The answer is no.
Okay. You know?
Didn't have a chance to look into the book, but the way it's accounted for right now is as a cancellation by the employee, which is to recognize everything directly. And I have some sympathy for that, because what else is it if that is one of the prerequisites for an employee to exercise this option? And if they say, no, I'm not going to pay it from this month on, and then they cannot exercise this option anymore, that seems to be like a cancellation from employee's side. And that's why I think looking at the principles in IFRS 2 makes a lot of sense to me. So I would struggle touching that again. I think what we have right now makes sense.
Okay, so the people who've spoken have spoken against doing more work on the save as you earn option. So our, not a staff recommendation, but I suppose I'll ask the question, does anybody disagree that we drop save as you earn out of this project? Okay. So we won't address save as you earn plans within this project. Okay, Michael and Jaiho, that takes us to the end of paper 3B. In the light of the decision we've taken, rather than looking at the underlying attributes of a principle, to focus on a definition, is there anything in the other papers, 3C, that you want to take us through?
I don't think directly, given that it appears the mood is to focus on the improvement of the definitions, clarity of the definitions, looking to U.S. GAAP whenever that's possible. I think then looking to most of the end answers that we have in paper 3C is going to be consistent with current IFRS 2, consistent with U.S. GAAP. Obviously, the one change is our Appendix A, which is the SAYE plans, but noted. And I guess I'd simply ask, do the members have any individual items they would like to talk about in light of only focusing on the definitions and not the attributes?
It's the same four suspects again. Five. Laurence.
Yeah, I would like to come back to the proposed definition of non-vesting conditions. It is defined as a condition that does not determine whether the counterparty vests in a share-based payment arrangement. I mean, particularly when reading Appendix G, I mean, if that condition effectively determines whether the counterparty will get the award, how can it be described as a non-vesting condition?
I guess I see a vesting condition as you must be in employment, have the requirement to remain in employment, and it determines whether or not you are entitled to exercise that award and obviously then take ownership of the stock, in a simple example. To the extent you don't have that requirement to remain in employment, our example, you're required to stay in employment for 2 years, but the performance target is met at the end of year three. In 2 years and 1 month, you do have the ability to leave. You can walk out of there, and on the day you are walking out of there, it is 100% in your control if you decide to activate the award or not. The measurement of how many awards you'll get isn't yet determined, but you have that right to exercise the award. So that's why I guess the staff see the item G to be a service vesting condition for 2 years, and then whether or not the third year target is met to not be a vesting condition, but yet something that should be captured in the grant date fair value measurement. That's my rationale.
I hear, but the reading drafting of non-vesting condition reflects on that.
If you have offline comments on our drafting, we welcome them.
Just on the examples, I think I heard some comments made before that what we would do is already what IFRS 2 says. I was just a bit alarmed that would mean we would be no more specific in the interpretation than IFRS 2 already is, because I think the examples that you've given indicate in a number of circumstances that the answer is not clear in IFRS 2, but applying this new definition, this is how you would come up with the answer. So I would encourage progress along the lines of what you've done in the example, where you have followed, to me, a reasonably clear principle to come up with the answer you've come up with, rather than just simply saying, well, the standard's clear, because I don't think it is. And I would support, if this is the direction we're going in, including these examples in the interpretation.
In paper 3D, we purposely did not try to capture all potential changes that may be made anywhere in IFRS 2. We tried to focus only on the authoritative portion, so we did not address implementation guidance or otherwise. In trying to make what we thought were concise definitions to be included in Appendix A, as opposed to the U.S. GAAP version, it includes specific examples within its definition. We instead took those specific examples and included those in Appendix B, the application guidance. So the effect of adding those two items, which are both authoritative, would broadly get you the U.S. GAAP. Is, are you saying your preference would be to add an implementation guidance or illustrative examples, one or more of these specific?
Yes, because these are the things we've been asked about.
Okay.
These are the things that are causing people difficulty in practice.
Okay.
Peter?
Make it short. I agree with Ruth. I think what we see in Appendix G and H is important. That was, as I understand it, also one of the questions that has been asked. So if you have multiple vesting conditions, performance time, is it different from the service condition? We should have an answer to that based on the new definition that we are working on. So I agree with you.
Scott?
I agree with everything in B through F, H and I, and I think it would help if they wound up somewhere retrievable. Appendix G is the one that I'm concerned about. I know that the accounting described here is different than what's being applied in U.S. GAAP. In fact, the paper Appendix G identifies Interpretation A and Interpretation B and suggests the better answer is Interpretation A. I believe that U.S. GAAP is interpretation not represented in this paper, so we'll call that Interpretation C. What is being applied in the example here is that we have a performance condition. It is measured over 3 years. The service requirement is only 2 years, so whatever expense, the attribution period is going to get recognized over 2 years. But even in year three, if the likelihood of achieving the performance target changes, we would update our estimate of cumulative expense related to that option. And, of course, the service period is now done, so any change in the probability of reaching the performance target would immediately flow through the income statement because the service period is completed. But even through the end of year three, we would continue treating changes to the likelihood of reaching the performance target as a performance condition, not in some other way. And I'm familiar with at least a half a dozen companies who have options with this kind of situation, and to my knowledge, they're all doing it the same way, and I'm not aware of objections being raised by either auditors or regulators. So if we think G as proposed is the right answer, that is different from U.S. GAAP, and we ought to talk to the FASB or whoever to make sure that companies aren't doing it wrong in the U.S. Or that the difference is one that people intend.
Is your understanding that the remeasurement is performed for equity classified awards as well as liability classified awards?
Mm-hmm.
And if there is an increase in the number of awards expected to meet the performance target, you said there's an increase in compensation. I presume the offset to that is an increase to equity.
Yes.
Is there also a similar decrease if the probability goes down?
Yes. The theory, for better or for worse, that people have accepted is that the company designed the award that way because they felt that the service provided over 2 years would play out in results, whatever the measurement target is, over 3 years. And therefore, we won't know until the end of 3 years whether your 2 years of service provided us with, you know, X value or Y value, if you wanted to reduce it to figures. And because performance conditions are taken into account by estimating the probability that you'll achieve the target, and that is separate from the attribution period, which is how many, you know, what period you have to provide service over, for better or for worse, that's what's fallen out.
Oh, you finished.
Andrew. No, the light went out.
But shoot, it's back on now. Sorry.
I think in the examples B and C, the staff are steering us towards non-compete provisions being non-performance, non-vesting conditions. I think that's worthy of further consideration because I think there are places elsewhere in IFRS literature which would imply that non-compete provisions might be indicative of performance. So there's possibly some consistency issues to think about there, particularly SIC 17 on transactions involving the legal form of a lease talks about obligations either to perform or to refrain from certain significant activities or conditions of earning the fee received. And I think there's also stuff in the exposure draft on revenue that might indicate that some non-competes and things like that might be indicative of performance.
I would think, yes, I agree with your references that we need to look at it a little further. I don't believe it would meet the definition of a vesting condition if an entity is not, or an employee is not providing service, either explicitly or implicitly. So unless we want to make an exception to the vesting condition, it's then going to have to be a non-vesting condition, which would mean you'd have to estimate at grant date the probability of whether the non-compete provision will be broken. So that would be, I guess, just from a following it through perspective, something to consider. But in at least as far as what I've seen in practice, and from the U.S. GAAP perspective, while there is explicit guidance on indications to consider in which this may be a deemed service requirement, if it's very painful for the employee to potentially leave such that they likely wouldn't and would remain actually in service, I'm not personally aware of a situation where they've actually called it a vesting condition, but rather it's always a contingent feature, so to say.
Word, Laurence?
On the definition of a contingent feature, which reads, a feature that is subsequently activated only if a related event occurs. I was wondering whether a target share price would meet the definition of a contingent feature?
Because that's an active feature that it in and of itself will determine how the award being satisfied or not. That is the target in and of itself.
Yeah, but if I read the text, I could make it fit in the definition of contingent feature.
Michael, did you change the definition of contingent feature?
No, but we did create the definition of contingent feature. it's a concept for which there is more guidance in U.S. GAAP, although there's not an explicit definition back in the Appendix E, I guess it would be in the FAS 123R. And current IFRS 2 has only the paragraph on reload features, which is, of course, raising some of the questions as to what exactly is a non-compete. So we were trying to capture a concept in our definition of non-compete features. If anyone, again, has any drafting, I welcome them.
Scott?
You got to me just before I decided to turn it off.
Okay. Guido?
Well, just to the discussion, to add something to the question, non-compete provisions 1 and 2 in Appendix B and C and contingent features. Maybe we could think about it in a way that this non-compete provision 1 and B, as I understand, there is a vesting, and after the vesting period, there are non-compete provisions, and if I break them, I have to pay back. C is something, there is no vesting. The vesting is at the end of the non-compete provision period. So maybe the distinction would be, and coming to contingent features there, is once we have a vesting, then everything that has to be done after the vesting period, the non-compete provision and also other contingent features, are dealt with as you are describing it here. So whenever that comes up, you account for that. But if the non-compete provision takes place within the vesting period, then it's a non-vesting provision. So just distinguish whether the non-compete provisions or other contingent features have to be met after the vesting or before the vesting. Maybe that's the way to address this issue. Just as a preliminary thought. Because I'm struggling with the difference between contingent features and non-compete provisions that have to be met after vesting. What is the difference between those two? Maybe there is no difference and we should account for them in the same way.
They're one and the same. Contingent feature is a broader concept that will capture both non-compete provisions and other things such as reload features and other things. It's a concept or meant to be concept.
All right, that conversation was actually, I think, useful to clarify what perhaps might go in as illustrative examples and ways that we can improve the clarity and understanding of this. So my understanding of what we've agreed this afternoon is that you will continue to work on this project, members of staff. Thank you, Jo-Ho. That I'll give you time to reflect, because you've got some changes in paper 3D that you might want to modify somewhat now, but that we focus on not the attributes of the principle, but we focus on the definitions themselves, either to keep the existing definitions and to amplify those, or to make necessary but minimal changes to the wording, but to try and bring ourselves in line with the US GAAP definition, certainly of performance conditions, that seems to be working well over there. To consider the extent then to which, having got those definitions, we need to develop interpretive guidance in addressing how to account for multiple vesting conditions, performance and service, and to also include some illustrative examples based on the ones that you've got in paper 3C. Is that your understanding as well?
Yes, my understanding is our to-dos for the next meeting are primarily drafting-based, so that you can consider specific drafting that we've thought about, specific examples as to whether they should or should not be included. And then with, I guess, maybe the one big takeaway, take a look at the Appendix G, multiple periods, differences in periods, and do a little more research on that to ensure that our technical analysis gets to the right question.
All right. And I suppose the question that certainly in Andrew's mind, if not anybody else's, is whether or not then we're going to proceed with an interpretation or an annual improvement. And in a way, I think we can only determine that when you've had a look to see the extent to which we need to develop interpretive guidance on the multiple vesting conditions aspect. Either way, though, it will require amendments to existing IFRS 2 to get the right words into the standard. So this is something that, Michael, you'll have to put before the board at some stage. Does anybody object to us continuing with the project on the basis that I've outlined?
Yeah? Sorry, I don't object wildly, but I just want to make sure that we are, we've asked Michael and Jeho to go away and do some more work, but if we're going to come back, we keep doing this meeting after meeting and without actually knowing what the end game actually is, and we say yes, we're going to make a decision, but if we're sitting around this table and some of us have very firm views, we want an interpretation, some of us think that it should perhaps go into the post-implementation review, I just wonder whether we are better to try to make that kind of decision today, because it may actually be that actually it's fruitless actually going away and doing some more work. And it just worries me that we're going from, and I know I'm talking process as opposed to the answers, but I think some of where we've got to, I mean, Ruth made the comment, I'm not sure we're going to make it any easier for, with where we're going. So I guess I just want to confirm that we are all in agreement that we really do want to do some more work, or should we actually have the discussion, even if for the next 15 minutes, about what we think the end answer might be, to see if we actually think that we can reach any agreement at all.
Sorry, Jared, when you say the end answer, you started talking about, is it an interpretation or anything else?
It is an interpretation.
Is that what you mean by the end answer?
Or nothing. So I don't mean what the end technical answer is. I mean the end product. Yes, that's the word I'm looking for.
Okay, that's fine. There's an easy answer to that, which is also the reason that I'm not putting that to you today, and that is that I don't think you should be asked to make decisions without the proper staff analysis. There are agenda criteria that we have to go through, and I'm afraid, even though I seem to be labouring the point, that I think you have to have formally the consideration that the staff has made as to which of the various agenda criteria this fits. Annual improvements, interpretations committee for an IFRIC, or in fact that it's a board project agenda decision. If it's a board project, then we don't have to do any more. So reluctantly, I suppose, in a public meeting, I have to admit that I'm encouraging you to keep working on this, because I think you are more likely to come to an answer that will assist our constituents to get to a conclusion sooner than if we make a decision today, for example, to pass this off into the post-implementation review of IFRS 2, which I can guarantee will not start any earlier than the second half of 2011, and I would think it probably will extend beyond there. Whereas if there is something that we can identify now and at the next meeting have come to a conclusion that says it's in part a change to the standard, depending on how much interpretive guidance we need to give to the multiple vesting conditions aspect, it may be something that can then go straight as a package to the board for their approval, or it's something that we would take through our due process area. So without trying to prejudge it, I doubt very much that this is going to meet the criteria for annual improvements. So that leaves us with two choices. one of which is we do the work and issue it ourselves. The other one is we pass the work in progress across to the board. And either way, I'm asking the staff who've been working on this for a while just to complete the circle, as it were, in the staff analysis. So whatever decision we take next month is something that can either be implemented by us really next meeting, or if it's something that can be a completed working process for the board.
And I guess to ensure the efficiency of the committee, after the staff has performed our analysis of what we believe would be the best path forward, I'm proposing that we focus our drafting efforts on where we think that analysis would be, on our recommendation, as opposed to creating two or potentially three potential drafts for you to go back and forth.
But can we perhaps then make sure that at our next meeting you do bring to us the paper of what was the issue we're actually trying to address in the first place? Like, what is it our constituents want answered? Because in some ways we've almost sort of forgotten that. or it's not in the papers to actually say what was the question asked, so that we do have that in front of us next time and what the options are. And I'm sorry, I'm going to add one to Bob's option, which is do nothing further. And I think that it may be that you say it, that's one that, you know, we can all say no, we disagree with doing nothing further, but I'd like to just come back to what was the question asked and what have we got, and therefore what are the options. But I think we need to have that in front of us, Michael, next time, because otherwise we'll be in the same position at the end of next meeting as well.
Michael, I'm sure we'll guarantee that. The one thing that we can't do is do nothing, because having been alerted to significant divergence in practice, and as Laurence keeps reminding us, that the words that we produce or the words that are there already are incapable of interpretation clearly in her mind, that there is something that we have to do, even if it's only to recommend to the board that it takes an action. We don't have to decide what it is, but we have to come up with a conclusion as to why we're not taking it on to our agenda, and therefore what the progression of this should be. Peggy?
I think it's clear that there's certainly diversity in practice and a lot of confusion in the IFRS world. As Scott had said, from a U.S. GAAP perspective, this is a pretty clear-cut area, so I would really encourage our group to try and come to some kind of a consensus on this, because stock options impact so many companies, and I mean, this is extremely pervasive, and it's probably only going to get worse, especially as you have countries like Canada going on to IFRS. I would think we'd want to do something, and if it's the most expeditious way to do it through this committee, then you know, I wholly support that. I would ask, though, that if in terms of getting ready for the next meeting, if there's something that we could get in advance, or if we need to do something in the interim in terms of taking a vote on some suggestions, I think we should also consider that, because it seems that we should not delay this any further.
So, Michael, will you give some consideration to having a meeting in the middle of August? Ruth?
Just going back to Joanna's point, what were the questions asked? I think the staff have answered those questions in the examples that you've gone through, because in your outreach to us and to others, the feedback that you received from us was these are the common situations that we're having trouble with in practice. And that's why I would certainly encourage the path of an interpretation with amending the standard, because and with some illustrative examples, because these are the questions that were asked. So I'd be very disappointed if we stopped here and did nothing, because this is exactly what has been asked of us, and I think the staff have done a lot of work to try to resolve it. I had just one question, though, in terms of going forward. The and-or model that you proposed in the last paper, which was to deal with multiple conditions and multiple service periods, do you propose to include that in this final document as well as something for people to keep thinking about as to how to address the issue of
multiple interacting conditions.
Yes, we plan to include some level of that guidance. Whether it's all of what's included in USGAP or not is still has to be thought of a little more, but there will definitely be some guidance on the interaction between multiple best conditions, the and versus or conditions, and how that works.
Because, again, I think that that and or model helps a lot too.
Yes, and that was one of the specific questions that was raised that brought this whole project up. Another one, what is a non-compete exactly? I can't remember the third off the top of my head, but those were two of the three.
Okay, so Jeho, we will look forward to welcoming you back with yet another paper with your analysis at our September meeting.
So our third and definitive meeting, is that correct?